The Tom Woods Show, episode 1027.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, everybody always thinks the current U.S. president must be the worst, but man, is there competition for that title. Check out our free course on the presidents and their crimes against liberty at freehistorycourse.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here, talking today to Stefan Molyneux, who's a guy who makes me look like a lazy bum in terms of content creation. He's got well over 3,800 podcast episodes over at freedomainradio.com. He also has a YouTube channel with a tremendous following. And in terms of his podcast, he's had well over 250 million downloads. He is the author, most recently, of The Art of the Argument, Western Civilization's Last Stand. Stefan, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Tom. It's great to be here. Good to chat again.
I'm glad to have you here on episode 1027, because as we were saying just before we went on, by an interesting coincidence, that happens to be your favorite number. So how about that? So 1027 it is.
Well, it's these joyful coincidences that coalesce to know that you're going to be producing some quality thought content.
That's right. That's right. So you have a brand new book, The Art of the Argument. And of course, we want to talk about that, and we're going to use that as a springboard to hit all kinds of topics. It seems to me that in the age of social media, we need some kind of a primer on the argument, probably more than ever. So why don't you start off by explaining what, in fact, it is that you mean in this book when you use the term the argument?
Well, a term just popped into my head while we were bringing this topic up, Tom, which is blindfolded butcher. And, you know, being a butcher, you know, whatever your culinary tastes or ethics, being a butcher is a precise and difficult job, something you wouldn't want to do blindfolded. And it seems to me, because of social media, because of the influx of people into higher education, we have a lot of people engaged in social discourse who don't really seem to know what they're doing, which is like a whole bunch of people swarming in, blindfolding themselves, picking up the butcher's chainsaw and going to town. And so public discourse is really degrading to the point where, as you know, like you try and be a non-radical leftist, give a speech at a university, you might get a bike lock to the head. People might throw fake blood at you, and they might pull fire alarms. They might drive cars into people, all of which, of course, do not fall into the category of what we happily would call an argument. And so I wanted to give the world a non technical, engaging way to understand what an argument is, some of the various different flavors of arguments, and why it's so important. I mean, it's like those old shows, you know, the little commercials, like the PS says, this is your brain, this is your brain on drugs. It's supposed to frighten you into not doing drugs. Hey, kids, don't do drugs. Or you would see some guy with no teeth rooting around through the garbage, and your parents would say, oh, that guy, you know, he tried crystal meth only once. And looking at the alternative is pretty terrifying. Or, you know, the people who don't take care of their teeth or whatever it is, right? People who gain too much weight. And so I wanted to show how much fun and how enjoyable and how mental, what great mental exercise a real argument is. And also to give the heaven of argumentation and the hell of whatever argumentation isn't, which tends to be, you know, bullying, unjust ostracism. It tends to be escalating violence, and it tends to be basically a new dark age. So I wanted to give people the lamp to aim towards and the dark to flee in a pretty compact and hopefully entertaining package.
Well, I don't think it's an exaggeration when you emphasize the importance of what you call the argument to civilization itself, because, of course, in the absence of argument and rational discourse, well, what is there? If that's not how we're going to, if reason is not the tribunal, then what will be? Might makes right, physical force, as you say, unjust ostracism, whatever. So that really is very important. Now, having said that, that argument is an alternative to violence. It's the alternative that civilized people prefer. What do you make of the argument we hear now on the left that when, let's say, a controversial right-wing speaker comes to campus, well, that person's arguments really amount to violence, or in the less extreme versions, let's say, they provoke violence or intended to provoke violence. So really, by suppressing that speech, we're really acting preemptively in self-defense.
It's a fascinating argument, morally horrifying and creepy as all get up. It's like some chilblain millipede crawling up your spine marrow to even conceive of it. But, you know, my sort of pushback on this would be sort of two major points. The first, of course, I mean, outside of the obvious free speech ones, which have been done to death, but the first would be that the left continually insists that you not blame the victim. The left continually insists that, let's say, some guy beats up his wife, and then he says, well, she was disrespecting me, or she didn't obey my order, or the steak wasn't the right temperature, or whatever, right? Or she's going out dressed in too revealing a set of clothes. Well, then you would say, well, I don't care what she did. You can't blame the victim. You can't say, well, this woman that I grabbed her boob was asking for it because she was wearing a low-cut top. You simply do not blame the victim for somebody who is violent. And then I'd love the leftists to try and square this circle. If you don't blame the victim of violence for whatever they did to provoke that violence, because no provocation justifies violence, if a man can't beat up his wife and then claim some ex post facto justification for it, then how on earth do conservative speakers bring on their own violence? That's sort of the first point. Like, if you're not going to blame the victim, then don't blame the damn victim. And that's something I would sort of strongly urge them to consider. The second thing is this weird, it's like the whole leftist belief system is like this giant donut with blood in the middle, or I guess a hole, right? Because on the one extreme, they say everything is relative, everything is subjective, we can never know the truth. This really postmodernist, I just did a debate with Dr. Thaddeus Russell about this, which people might want to check out. I found it very enjoyable, and he was very frank and charming in his beliefs. And so on the one hand, they say, well, you can never know anything for sure. Everything's relative. Everything's subjective. And on the other hand, they say, I know the ideas are so of conservatives are so irredeemably evil and absolutely horrible that I'm justified in beating them up. And I just, those two, like, I'm not certain enough to beat people up for their beliefs, even if I thought it was morally justified, because you figure out the best belief system through the free marketplace of ideas, in the same way you figure out the best product in the free marketplace of products. And so this idea that everything's relative, everything's subjective, you can't know anything for certain, but Charles Murray is so irredeemably evil, we have to drive him off campus with threats of force. These two make no sense at all. And if the leftists are going to start to look at those, I think they'll find a little bit more tolerance. And if they're not, well, they've ejected themselves from the category of the argument, which is very dangerous.
Doesn't that make you think, though, that maybe for them, relativism is really just a pose? They don't actually, in their heart of hearts, believe in relativism. They certainly don't think that somebody, for example, who believes in traditional gender roles has a view that's just as valid as theirs and who's to say which one should be chosen. So they're really full of it when they say they're relativists.
Relativism on the left is the project of universal disarmament for the right. Relativism for the left, they project relativism out there, Tom, in order to get their enemies to lay down their certainties, to say, well, you know, I guess you're right. I guess Einsteinian physics did supersede Newtonian physics, so I guess you can beat me up. You know, like, I mean, they don't actually have any goals of embracing relativism themselves. It's kind of this lure that is put out there in order to disarm their opponents and to cast doubt into the minds and hearts of their opponents.
Let me bring up a phrase you've become well known for. Now, maybe you're afraid, what phrase is this going to be? But it's not an argument. Mm. A lot of people started using not an argument when somebody will say something to them that really does not constitute any form of an argument. They'll just say not an argument. You know, go ahead and give me an argument. I don't know when you started doing that, but it is associated with you. What do you mean when you say not an argument?
Well, it's coaching. I mean, if you've ever played sports and ever been coached to a reasonably qualified level, what does your coach say most of all? That's wrong. That's incorrect. I mean, I remember when I was learning how to give a good serve in tennis, you know, I had a coach who was like, yeah, reach over the top. And if you go to try and improve, I don't play golf, but I know that from people who do, you try and improve your golf swing, you get all of this micromuscular management of the golf pro telling you, oh, don't jump out of your shot, lean into it, shoulders back. Like, 95% of what you receive when you're trying to become good at something is negative feedback. And that's good because being right is very hard and being wrong is very easy. So, of course, whenever you try anything, you're going to be wrong a lot more than right. So basically what I want to do with that phrase is I want to point out when people aren't making arguments. And it's not meant to humiliate. It's not meant to, you know, like if you show up to play tennis with a hockey stick, I'm going to say, not a tennis racket. I mean, sorry, you can play something. You could play sophistry if you want. You can play emotional regurgitation, but you can't play argument. You can't play thought. You can't play philosophy. And so I just want to point out to make the people who are making the arguments, and in many ways, they're doing so in good faith because they've been so misinformed about how to have rational influence in the public sphere. They think that sophistry is philosophy and they think that philosophy is violence. And so I want to point out to those people, that's not an argument. And of course, I wanted to point out to the audience, to the people who are reading or who are listening or participating in the conversation, that's not an argument. And of course, at some point after using that phrase for some time, I did get a lot of requests to say, okay, Mr. Negative, Mr. Nagy, perhaps you'd like to tell us not what an argument isn't, but what an argument is. And that was, of course, the birth of the book.
So give me an example of something somebody might say to you on Twitter, let's say, that would lead you to respond, not an argument. Just an example.
Oh, let me ruffle through my mental Rolodex of infinity. But it would be something like, you know, Steph, I love you, but you're totally wrong on this. You know, those or the concern trolls, you know, I'm concerned that if you broadcast this information, people might take it the wrong way and it might have bad results. Or your argument, your perspective is so offensive. Or, well, you are a white male, so you're off the island, or anything like that. I mean, where people simply are substituting consequences or emotions or vague negative insinuations or anything like that in order to try and discredit what it is that you're saying without addressing either your data or your reasoning.
Let's think about, again, given the, oh, I don't know, this the overwhelming, just the tidal wave of inanity that one encounters on social media. The types of bad, I don't even know if they rise to the level of arguments that we encounter. Now, in your book, you identify one with the acronym. I don't know how to pronounce an acronym. I guess I think there's we can be agnostic on the pronunciation of acronyms. But I could see it being pronounced NAWALT. Not all women are like that. So, for example, you cite a study that says, you know, scientists find that in general, women tend to do such and such more than men. And if it's something interesting or controversial sounding, the response you get a lot is, well, I know women who don't act that way, or I'm a woman and I don't do that. That is not, that does not refute this paper. And so it's even gotten to the point where it has its own acronym, NAWALT, for that so-called argument. Not all women are like that. So that's an example. What other things can we identify that we might want to sharpen our rhetorical knives against that we're going to come up against in social media? I mean, probably it's some of the ones you just mentioned.
Yeah, this one is tragically common. And I mean, if I were to go the cliched route, then I would say, look at me being very brave in this. But if I were to go the cliched route, Tom, I would say, well, statistics can be a little bit challenging, and Lord knows women have taken over the education, and a lot more women tend to be math phobic than men, and I'm wondering if women taking over early education has had something to do with the fact that people seem to grow up with no grasp of the bell curve or these statistics of any kind. Like, I put out a video recently talking about the correlation, which is, of course, not always explicitly causation and contains within its very definition lots of capacity for exceptions, that IQ and obesity tend to be inversely correlated. So the higher your IQ, the less likely you are to be obese. And this is true for a wide number of factors. Now, of course, I put this out, and I used to put out caveats, you know, like, well, there are exceptions, but then I realized it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, makes no difference.
If people are strongly determined to not understand you, then putting out caveats actually seems to increase it, because in their mind, it makes you look weak and faltering and wavering and so on. And so, of course, a number of people wrote back and said, well, I have an IQ of 12 million, which is also the number of pounds I have in my middle. And, you know, it's like, okay, but this is like the short Danish guy. You know, Danes tend to be the tallest people on the planet. And if you say that, and then they say, well, I know a guy from Denmark and he's short. So what does that mean? It's the exception, you know, the old phrase that I grew up with, which doesn't seem to be common anymore. It's the exception that proves the rule. In other words, if you can really remember a short Danish guy, as opposed to, say, a short guy from Japan, then it's because you remember him because it's a deviation. It's the exception that proves the rule. Things are memorable because they're unusual. And so if you know a short Danish guy, this kind of thing. So this problem is really weird because most of what we talk about when we're looking at empirical facts in society are generalizations. Of course they are. They have to be generalizations because we're talking about a large group of people. And in any large group of people, any characteristic you talk about tends to be on a bell curve, right? Which means that there's a cluster around the middle and there's extremes at either end, right? Think of intelligence, right? Intelligence, there's a cluster around the middle, sort of 85 to 115 or 90 to 110. And that's where the majority of people are. And then there are exceptions on the low end and exceptions on the high end. Same thing with height, right? There's middle and really tall people and not so tall people and so on. And this, you know, whenever you want to talk about society, which is kind of where philosophy should be aimed at, is the improvement and edification of social ethics. Well, you have to use generalizations based upon population aggregates, which always include exceptions. And the idea that you disprove the trend by citing an exception is a huge paralysis in any meaningful and rational conversations about how to improve society. It's one of these, when I was a kid, like we had skateboards when I was a kid, which, you know, I guess for my younger listeners thinks that means like a Flintstone skateboard. And we used to do this game where we'd sit on the skateboards. We didn't do these kind of flips and tricks and, you know, let's put it through a Mobius strip patchwork of in and out of X dimension, which kids do with the flipping skateboards. We kind of went down hills. And we used to gather a handful of sticks and we'd sit on our skateboards, or the brave people would stand, and we'd go down a hill and you try and throw your sticks in front of other kids' skateboards because it was a race, but you were allowed to, quote, cheat, right? And it stole the other person's progress. And if you threw it just right and the stick was just the right size, what would happen is the skateboard would just would stop. And, you know, that's why you sat, because it was easier to roll off it than it was to fly off it vertically. And this, you know, okay, here's, you know, we're building the case for a general trend that explains a lot of differences in societies and so on, which helps us understand that it's not injustice or prejudice or bigotry or sexism or racism necessarily that explains group differences. There may be other reasons. And so you're building this case, you're going down this hill, you're getting some good speed on your skateboard. And then someone comes along with this idiot exception thing. I know a short Danish guy. And then, you know, it stops the whole thing. Like, it's just the right size and at just the right angle. And to many people, of course, you go flying, because what you have to do is you have to go back and explain 2 and 2 make 4 to people, which interrupts the whole flow. And I kind of think that's the point.
Well, I think in part, some of this has to do with the fact that you're dealing with people. If I were to make a generalization about laptop computers and say, you know, a lot of laptop computers just tend to last only 2 or 3 years if you really use them heavily. Nobody would be outraged or offended by that, or would feel it necessary to say, well, I heard of a guy who had a laptop that lasted 11 years. But if they did say that, they'd say, now, that's highly unusual, I'll grant you, because you're right, it usually is 2 or 3. Nobody's offended. Nobody feels the need to rush to contradict you. In your whole life, I mean, the length of time it takes before an apple goes bad or something or whatever, these are things that maybe vary ever so slightly from one particular case to the next, but we don't take offense at this. So it's manufactured, because obviously there's no problem people have in making generalizations in other parts of their lives. Now, here's the thing.
Just before we go on, wanted to point out very, very briefly, Tom, sad to say, it's not just people. I mean, there was a dog association that put out a manual on dogs and dog breeding. Did you hear about this at all?
No, but I can already see where it's going.
Yeah, you know where this goes, right? So they put out this manual on dogs and dog breeding, the various characteristics of dogs. And don't you know, Tom, these evil dogists, they talked about varying degrees of intelligence within dogs. And people got so enraged and upset that they had to pull the whole manual, rewrite it from scratch, start all over again, and not include anything which talked about different levels of intelligence in dogs, which everybody knows about and is perfectly clear, which is why certain dogs are chosen for more complex tasks and so on. But yeah, it's not just people, but in general. Oh, look at me quoting an exception to disprove your rule. It is, absolutely. It is everywhere where a lot of this stuff comes up, wherever. I guess this probably would cast a shadow on human society if people extrapolated, but it's in a lot of places.
I sure wish we had H.L. Mencken still around. I would love to hear his response to this world we live in. Now, the thing is, the argument really sums up what it is to be human as opposed to belonging to any other species, because we have the ability to reason and draw conclusions on the basis of evidence. And yet, we're not that good at it as a species, oddly enough. I mean, yeah, I mean, look, we've made tremendous scientific progress. So there is evidence that some of us are decent at it. But in terms of, here's a controversial argument. Are you capable of assessing the evidence and coming to a conclusion rationally? We're not as good at it as you'd think we'd be. We're more emotional, or we're more inclined to dismiss a generalization on the basis of anecdotal evidence. And yet, given that this is the defining characteristic of human beings, that they're capable of reason, it's a little discouraging how not good at it we are. I mean, this tends to make me somewhat misanthropic at times.
Well, I know what you mean, Tom, and I go back and forth on this because I don't know whether our general incapacity to reason these days is environmental or innate or biological or genetic or whatever. I mean, I've seen studies. I've got this whole presentation called The Death of Reason. There's a study which I'll just mention, which is people read a moral argument and justified it, right? There was a page of moral argument. And then they'd set up the page so that when you closed the book and then opened it again, it opened to a slightly different moral argument, but with opposite conclusions, slightly different reasoning, but opposite conclusions. And what happened was, so people perfectly fluidly justified the argument. They closed the book and they said, oh, could you just run that through that justification once again? They opened the book and they justified the opposite moral argument with no notice or no definition. You've seen this thing too, where if people go out into the street and they talk about Trump's tax plan to people, but they say it's Bernie Sanders' tax plan, people love it. Like it's just become teams. No value. Now, as far as whether it's innate to be that irrational, I don't really think it is. You know, if you have some club where everyone gets their heads forcibly shaved and then you say, wow, these people are not very good at growing hair, it's like, well, maybe, but let's find out what happens if we don't shave them. And so this really came home to me hard as a parent, and maybe you've had the same experience. See kids, and Jeff Tucker talks about this in one of his books, you see kids negotiating their Halloween candy. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you know, it's like those livestock, like the guys who call out the livestock stuff, you know, incredibly rapid fire discussion. I mean, kids are trading back and forth, stuff flying all over the place. The resources are being allocated in a free market of trading. And this they're doing at 6, 7, 8 years old. There's an innate trading capacity that we have. I think when it comes to reason as well, I think we're born rational. And I think it's chased out of us. I think it's scared out of us. I think it's bullied out of us. I think it's humiliated out of us. I think it's punished out of us. And I guess it's the giant experiment. As a father, you know, I have committed to only reasoning with my child. And man, she's like a mini Dershowitz on speed. I mean, she is just like really able to integrate. And, you know, I was so proud of her when she was 5. And she said to me, Daddy, that's not an argument. It's fantastic. So, you know, whether that is her genetics, I mean, I like reason, maybe. I mean, there could be genetic explanations for it as well, but I have found that by not putting her in environments and not subjecting her to environments wherein rationality is punished, but rather rewarded, it's like, if you can make a good case for it, you can have it. I have found that she has not turned to sophistry. She's not turned to manipulation, and she's very rational. So that's not proof. That's a sample size of one. As we all know, the plural of anecdote is not data, but it is still interesting to me. And I wonder if we were raised with respect for reason, you know, with the trivium, with Socratic reasoning being taught all the way up in schools, if we were taught all of that and it enhanced our natural capacity to bargain and to make arguments. And if instead deviations were punished, like if you make a bad case, I don't mean like you hit kids or anything, but if you didn't win the argument, if you made a bad argument, then because we all want to win, or at least most of us, I wonder how much we could be rational if we were positively reinforced for rationality and negatively reinforced for sophistry.
You know, sometimes when I'm joking around with the kids, I'll make an invalid argument, you know, an appeal to the crowd or whatever. And the trouble is, my eldest daughter, Regina, who's 14 now, studied logic formally in her middle school years. She immediately identifies the fallacy I'm committing, and it ruins all my fun. But at the same time, I'm glad to know that she knows that stuff. Now, I want to talk about another point that is in your book, The Art of the Argument, and that is sometimes we find ourselves being accused of bad will, that instead of addressing the merits of the case, for example, you give the case of the single mother, and you're saying that there are cases in which, I mean, obviously we want to help these people, but you want to help them in ways that aren't going to undermine them, that aren't going to, and this would be true of any person who's in a difficult situation. You don't want to do things that are going to increase the amount of time they're in this unfortunate situation, or make it pay for them not to get their act together and that sort of thing. And the response that you get is, you're a terrible person. Or if you believe in the free market economy, well, because everybody knows the free market economy makes people poor, you must be a terrible person. Now, that's also not an argument, but it's a pretty darn common non-argument.
Right. Well, yeah, I did. And this is one of, I think, to reinforce your point about sometimes despairing about humanity. One of the biggest videos I've ever done is a debate with a flat earther.
Yes, that's right. Didn't that get over, how many views did that get? Am I remembering that?
Well north of a million.
It was over a million. I thought so.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, you put all this work into making these arguments and then you, anyway. So, and the funny thing is, in some of those comments, there is this rank psychologizing, this rank, you know, impugning of motives as a pretend argument. You know, like, you can see, they say, you can see as the debate goes along, the growing fear in Steph's eyes as he begins to realize that his entire paradigm is about to collapse. And, you know, like, all the, they're reading body language and eye ticks and so on, right? And, well, it is true that I did feel a certain amount of fear in that conversation. But it wasn't because I thought the world was flat. It's because I was realizing that some people really believe that the world is flat. It was more a fear of my fellow carbon-based life forms and bipeds than it was of the actual conclusions. And this psychologizing is easy, and it's very lazy. And it is a form of ad hominem, which is to say, well, you have bad motives, you have bad intentions, therefore I can dismiss your argument. And it is really like, you know, the tiger gets closer and you close your eyes and go, la, 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 I guess just allowing the tiger to find you quickly. But all it does, I really want people to see, this is what the not an argument thing is about, Tom. I really want people to see when someone's not making an argument. Because, you know, we all do it. We all do it from time to time and put out something, say, oh, hey, you know, I could have done that better, or that really wasn't my best work or whatever. And so if somebody says not an argument and it's not an argument, and you say, you know what, I kind of slipped a little there. The chain came off the cog for a moment, but we'll put it back on. Let me try this again. Okay, that's fine. That's honorable. That's decent. We all make mistakes. But if somebody just plows on regardless or ignores, I want them to be discredited in the realm of ideas. And again, it's not because I hate them, but, you know, if you're trying to win a choir competition, you've got to, you know, take the guy who sounds like an orc being crucified out of the mix because he's going to make everyone sound bad and you just can't get beauty with discordant notes. And so the ostracism aspect is something I really talk about a lot in the book. And this is one of the problems of the state redistribution of resources is we lose the capacity to ostracize people for bad decisions, which is how society was much more peacefully run in the past. And so, yeah, I really do want people to see when other people aren't making an argument so that they can evaluate their future contributions accordingly.
How about advice you have for debaters? It's one thing to teach people the structure of a good argument, but there's really no substitute for the content of the argument. You have to know your stuff if you're going to come out on top. You really do have to know your stuff. Now, depending on your opponent, you have to know more or less stuff. There's no substitute for knowing your stuff, but let's assume I know my stuff. What's some advice that you, as somebody who's been doing this for a long time, can give me in terms of how I can be successful, not necessarily persuading my opponent that I'm right, but at least making onlookers sit up and take notice that, well, this guy at least knows what he's talking about?
I think for me, Tom, and it's an unusual perspective, but I found it to be very powerful. It's not about me and it's not about you. You know, if let's say I have two friends and they're both single, they're both lonely, want to get married and have kids. And I know they'd be really, really good for each other. And so I arrange a dinner party and I have them sit next to each other. I introduce and I, you know, point out a couple of interesting things about each other with the goal of starting the conversation. My particular goal there is not to evaluate whether they like me or whether they like the food or the decor or the music. My goal there is to evaluate whether they like each other. I'm introducing two people to each other with the hopes that I can help my friends be happier. And my focus there, it's not about me. It's about those two and whether they're getting along. And turning yourself invisible in that context can be really challenging because a lot of people approach debates like they want to win. They approach debates like the goal is victory. Now, in a public debate, I'm not talking really private debates, but it's a different category. But in a public debate, the goal is not to beat your opponent. The goal is to introduce truth to the audience. So think of it like two people at a dinner party. You want them to like each other. You think they will, and you think they'll be happier if they do. So your focus is on them. It's not on yourself. And so when it comes to a public debate, the goal is to introduce the truth to your audience through the mechanism of debate, which is a great way of doing it. Because what happens is if you just present an argument, people have objections in their head. And it's really tough to keep interrupting your own argument to address the objections that they have in their head. Whereas if you have a debate, those objections are vocalized and you can deal with them in the moment without having to interrupt everything. So it's a great way. So if your goal, of course, is to introduce the truth to your audience, forget about yourself. And people focus on dominating the other person, which makes you kind of instantly unlikable. Because the thing is, too, if you're really, really good at debating and your opponent is not, you don't want to be like the Mike Tyson beating up on the Girl Guide person. It's not very, like, I really don't like that Mike Tyson guy beat up on that Girl Guide. And so if you focus on, in a sense, making yourself invisible, making yourself a sort of clear pane of glass through which the audience can see the truth, then you take the ego out of it and you take the sort of simian desire to conquer out of it. And I think that is the best way to get the audience to focus on the truth rather than on you, which is the goal.
This may sound like a juvenile question, but I still feel compelled to ask it. Do you yourself engage in, you know, debates on social media, particularly Twitter, or do you think that's a waste of time? Or once in a while, do you just lob a grenade over at the other camp and just let it go? Or how do you handle that? I feel like sometimes I do that because it just makes me feel better. But then I think about the opportunity cost of what I could have accomplished during that time, and then I feel like a fool. So I'm curious about your opinion on that.
For me, at least, it's tough to beat couple of 100,000 views and downloads as a sort of bare minimum. I mean, I sort of have a base of like 100,000 views on YouTube, and it usually goes up from there, a couple of 100,000 downloads. And so for me, it's tough to compete with those kinds of numbers. And I'm also, you know, I have my strengths and my weaknesses. One of my strengths is, you know, an engaging and enjoyable capacity to discuss ideas with a curious ability to not offend people. And I think that's because I don't have an agenda for the most part. I mean, other than, you know, focusing on the truth, which is really the opposite of an agenda. So for me, if I have sort of my personal charisma at play, my eye contact at play, my sense of humor at play, my positivity at play, my happiness at play, that's all something that I can communicate very easily in a video or even in the audio, which is what we're doing now. And so it's hard for me to sort of stack those two together and say, I'm going to strip all of my strengths out and I'm going to start to go back and forth in a very constrained medium. And of course, as you know, 90% of communication is nonverbal and written is even less, right? There's no capacity for irony. People don't know if you're joking. Like, I can roll my eyes and use an exaggerated tone if I'm mocking someone. It's tough to replicate that in text. And so for me, it's very tough to get the numbers and to get the clarity, to get the engagement on social media compared to looking in a camera, either, and this can be in a debate, like a live debate, I much prefer. So that's sort of the calculus that goes on in my head, and that's where I try to guide that decision.
I just clicked on your YouTube channel, and unfortunately, your welcome video started right up, which I didn't realize would happen. But I do need to take just a minute to say something, if I may, about or ask you about Stefan Molyneux Inc., so to speak, because it really is quite something what you've built up here. I mean, your YouTube channel has in excess of 685,000 subscribers. I mean, that's a veritable miracle. But it's not a miracle in the sense that it happened at random, but that even with a lot of hard work, a lot of people would be very lucky to get even a tiny fraction of that. And that's not to mention your podcast downloads and everything else. So I guess I'm curious about, let's leave aside, you know, you might say, well, I put out quality content. No doubt about that. A lot of people put out quality content. So the question is, when you look back on this, what do you attribute this to? I remember first encountering you in the form of articles. I used to read your articles. And then, I mean, I don't know the last time I read an article by you, actually, because I think you do basically what I do, which is mostly podcasting and stuff like that now.
I will script stuff on occasion, like movie reviews and so on, because In the heat of rhetoric, I often forget, oh, this character's name is this. And when I make those kinds of mistakes, it drives me crazy.
Right.
So okay. I will script a few things. Yeah, but mostly it's extemporaneous.
And most of my writing actually goes out to my mailing list. Those are the people who get to read my articles every day. I write stuff for them. But anyway, so I'm curious about what you attribute that to or any tips you might give to people who want to produce content. who want to make good arguments, let's say, but they feel like if nobody can hear them, what's the point of making them?
Right, right. Well, it's funny because somebody just posted the, I think it was yesterday, posted on a video that I did in 2006. Oh, Lordy. Oh, Lordy. I think I was like user 7 on YouTube or something. And somebody posted a video like saying, wow, you've been doing this for a long time. And that, you know, when people want advice, my concern is that they want shortcuts. And I'm not sure that there are any. I mean, I've had a very peculiar constellation or aligning of the planets with regards to skill set. So, I mean, I did a lot of debating in high school. I was on the debate team. I was on the debate team in college and came in, I think, top 5 or top 6 in Canada my first year. So I've had a lot of experience and a lot of process of doing that. I have written a whole bunch of stuff which has never seen the light of day, like all the way back to intellectual journals and books that have never been published and so on. So I've had a sort of lot of practice. I did, of course, in theater school. I learned how to control my voice. I learned how to sort of connect the mind and the heart, the brain and the soul, so to speak. That the sort of physical work, body work, movement classes, gymnastics, and sword fighting. It really, and learning how to connect your intellectual capacity with your emotional capacity, which has particularly with Shakespeare, is very, very important because he's such an intellectual writer. So it's a lot of things that have come together, plus, of course, a lifetime of just debating anyone I can get my hot little hands on. And so when something kind of clicks, and then, of course, you know, a decision to abandon political agnosticism in the run-up to the Trump election and starting to focus on current events much more so has helped. So I would say, you know, expect it to take a long time. If you're looking at somebody who's a really great ballerina and you say, well, what are your tips? You know, it's like that old joke, guy goes up to someone in New York and says, how do you get to Carnegie Hall? And the guy says, practice, practice, practice. And there is a phenomenon to a lot of people where somebody just erupts out of nowhere and it's the old cliche of the 10-year overnight success. You know, like I remember when Huey Lewis popped in the scene and people were like, wow, where's this guy coming from? It's like, well, 10 years of the bar scene. And it's the same thing with INXS. They had done like their backwater tours of Australia for many, many years. Same thing with Queen. They sort of toiled in the trenches for 10 years and then sort of hit it big. So it's, you know, if you love it, then you should do it for the rainbow, not the pot of gold. Like if you love something, you should do it not because you want to be famous or you want to have, you should do it because you love it. And if you love it, and if you're passionate about it, and if you can unite that love and that passion with a higher calling, a higher cause, then there's really nothing that can stop you. And if you don't love it, then I don't think whatever pot of gold you have at the end of that rainbow, I don't think that will be enough to sustain the journey.
I feel compelled to just ask a little bit more about this. I'm curious about when you got started producing all this content, you did it presumably in your spare time, you had a full-time job. Did you envision it as always remaining that way? Or was there a part of you that thought, maybe someday I could do this full-time? And by the way, what was the turning point where you said, I can forget my regular job, I can do this?
I said, we really want to lift a lid on this grandiosity? Sure. Okay, fine. So from a very young age, Tom, I always felt destined for great things. Took its own sweet time getting there. Let me tell you that. That's like it's my 4-decade plan. I've really been working on it for quite some time. It's the business plan that stretches back to the dawn of time. But no, I always felt that I had something of importance to offer the world. I mean, I started writing short stories when I was 6 years old. I wrote my first science fiction novel when I was 11. I mean, so for me in particular language, and then when I discovered philosophy through a friend of mine who loved the band Rush, whose drummer was a big fan of objectivism, and that sort of got me started on my whole journey to philosophy, I've always felt or believed that I had something of great value to offer the world. But what happens is, what happened for me at least, is that every avenue I tried to pursue that in turned out to be a dead end for reasons I didn't understand at the time, which I understand a lot more about now. So I was going to go into the art world. I studied playwriting and I was going to do, you know, screenplays and be an actor and did some of that, but I couldn't stand the leftism in, you know, well, you talk about the art world, then try layering in Canada over that art will, and everyone's dependent on the state, and it's just, it was not good, and very, very lefty to the point of, you know, many of them open communists. Couldn't sustain myself. And then academia, you know, and I did very well in academia. I mean, one of the first essays I wrote was read out by the professor to the class of 200 people as an example of a near perfect essay, and did very well and so on. And then found that it just kind of petered out. And again, you know, the way that academia is set up, but again, more so in Canada, I think, than in America, there is this problem of leftism and this in-group preference that the left has. I mean, as you know, and I know, they have no interest in diversity whatsoever. They're interested in diversity for their enemies, right? Because if you can get the enemy army to all end up speaking different languages, they're a lot easier to conquer. But you want a mono language in your own culture, which is leftism in higher education. And then I went into the business world and worked for many years, founded a company, grew it and sold it, and was an entrepreneur. But, you know, there were problems in the business world as far as integrity goes. There is this short-term time preference of pump up your stock value in the quarter, which leads you, I think, to make some very compromised decisions, or at least there's a lot of pressure to make those very compromised decisions for the long-term health and happiness of the company. And so I did. I started writing, and then when the internet, and in particular podcasting, because then I get to leverage the accent, which in everyone's mind adds at least 20 unjustified IQ points to whatever it is that I'm saying, I began to work in that realm, and I had a long commute, so I recorded in my car and found that, I mean, I knew I was going to really enjoy it, found that I enjoyed it, and I was good at it. And it's, to put this in a religious context, you know, when you're young, you ask, what should I do? What do I want? And then when you're older, hopefully, or maybe when you're younger too, you say, what does God want? What does the world want? What does the world need? And when it came to looking at my career as a software entrepreneur, I was doing some good and doing some valuable stuff and some interesting stuff, and it was good money. But I sort of fundamentally thought to myself, and in conversation with friends and family, I sort of thought to myself, what does the world need most? Does the world need a philosopher or somebody who's good at explaining philosophy? Or does the world need another software entrepreneur? And when you ask the right questions in life, the answers become obvious, which is why so many people cloud their questions. And so for me, and for the world, I mean, I enjoyed the software entrepreneurial life and stability and, you know, no public hatred, which was, you know, kind of a plus. But when you ask, what does the world need? And you subjugate yourself to what's best for the world, or at least what you think is best for the world, those decisions, in a sense, are taken out of your hands, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. Now, on the other hand, you do still need to support yourself, right? I mean, it's nice to do what you're doing, but you do need to support yourself. So what I find interesting is the model that you're using. You don't have ads. And at first, because you haven't had ads from the beginning, I don't think you've ever run an ad. Am I right about that?
Never. No, never run ads.
Never. Okay. Now, I sometimes run ads, but if they ended tomorrow, it wouldn't even affect me in any way. It's just a nice little icing on the cake. But at first, I thought, because I see a lot of people who say, I don't run ads, and they act like that makes them purer than other people because they don't run ads. And I always felt like, no, ads are part of capitalism. I'm not ashamed of them. I'm going to use them.
Sure.
But on the other hand, there is a wisdom to not running ads in that you don't ever have to feel like, how's the sponsor going to feel about this if we have this right. conversation, you know?
Right.
And there have been legitimate times when I've said, you know, with this episode, I better not run that ad. I'll run it on tomorrow's, you know, more innocuous episode. So I can definitely see the merits of that. So I wasn't suggesting that you were one of the snooty, I'm against ads people, but there really is an advantage to not doing it and simply to appealing directly to the audience. What helps is when you have an audience of your size, you only need the tiniest percentage of them to feel like your work is supporting for you to be comfortable.
Yeah, and maybe this comes from my Christian upbringing, but there were no ads at the church.
Yeah.
You know, there wasn't like the troop of Satan didn't come up and say, we've got an alternative perspective for you. Come this way to the orgy. And so the idea that a moral enterprise could be supported by those who believe in it, well, that's how the church runs. I mean, and so that was not too shocking to me. And of course, I knew the historical example of philosophers who were kept alive, often by patrons, but sometimes, you know, Socrates would just say, buy me lunch, let's chat. Yeah, I got to eat. And, you know, I can give you food for thought in exchange. So I knew that was going to work. There were a couple of reasons, and I'll just touch on them briefly, but a couple of reasons why I resisted ads for so long, and also why I ended up, at least until the new book, giving away my books, which are all still available at freedomainradio.com/free. All my existing books are available for free, audiobooks and PDFs and so on. But first of all, there is the natural cynicism of people who've been burned by sophists. You know, the sort of the holy roller preachers who, you know, preach the virtue of poverty and drive their Rolls Royces. So there is, of course, when you present people with startling arguments, the natural defense is to attempt to wipe them off the blackboard of the mind. Like, the people just look for a magic spell. Like, the demon of thought arises in their mind, and like, the first thing they want is an exorcism. So if you give people an excuse to dismiss your ideas without evaluating them, that is not, I think, in the service of virtue, thought, philosophy, and so on. And so I really, really wanted to not give people that excuse. You know, engage with the ideas, challenge me in the arguments, push back on the evidence, let's have a conversation. But if there were ads running, at least for me, that would give people an excuse to jump off the bus. Oh, this is just clickbait. Oh, he's just doing this for ads. Oh, he's just being controversial because it gets views and he gets money and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So that was sort of number one. Number two was, I also knew the economic relationship. When you run ads, to some degree, your business is not delivering truth to your audience, but delivering your audience to advertisers. And this is, again, no disrespect to ads. They're a fundamental part of the free market, and they're fine, but it does change the relationship in subtle ways. And I always wanted the audience to know that I was doing what I was doing with the hope and the goal of improving their lives, improving their thought patterns, improving their relationships, improving their opportunities. And for me, also, you know, I mean, if you're talking about economics and an ad pops up for gold, that's kind of in line. But because I talk about everything, you know, we talk about economics and philosophy, metaphysics, epistemology, dreams, ambitions, careers, personal relationships, love, marriage, sex, children. We talk about everything. And, you know, when somebody's talking about something really personal, or I'm talking about something really personal, which I'm certainly fine doing, and an ad pops up for gold, it's just a little bit more jarring. And I kind of saw that as a problem. And again, that's not a problem with ads. It's just the sort of random or schizoid content of the show being all over the map. It's tough to find anything that would match and would not feel like perhaps an intrusion into sometimes more personal moments. And last but not least, of course, I knew that there was going to be a vulnerability down the road. Either social, like something like YouTube, or like either it wasn't going to succeed, in which case ads wouldn't really matter, or it and I were going to succeed, in which case there would be a focus on demonetizing whatever it is that I was doing. The left, I mean, this is what the left does, right? I mean, not just the left, but this is what sophists do on the left and the right. They don't engage your ideas. They don't engage your arguments. They don't engage with your evidence. They, you know, smear you. They slander you. They try to destroy your reputation, and they go after your source of income. And so I didn't like the vulnerability of having an external authority over my source of income. And so I'd rather do the slow but steady build of just doing the ask, which, you know, I mean, I've asking for money is never, oh, yay, I get to do that today, or I need to do that today, or that's important to do today. But again, it's just about subjugating yourself to a higher ideal. You know, missionaries don't want to necessarily go to the backwaters of Africa, but they have a higher ideal to pursue. So you take the discomfort in pursuit of that. So those were sort of some of the reasons that I tried to avoid it.
All right, let's pause for a word from our sponsor. I'm only kidding. I don't have a sponsor.
Buy some gold.
How could I not put that in there? All right, listen, I'm going to link to basically everything Stefan Molyneux there is at tomwoods.com/1027. But for now, so that's going to include a link to your book, The Art of the Argument, which we've talked about in this conversation, but also your website, your social media, YouTube channel included. But if you want to give somebody a website or two or a link or two right now who might be too lazy, let's say, to go to tomwoods.com/1027, then we are all ears.
Well, sure. I mean, you can go to freedomainradio.com for that. You can follow me on Twitter at Stefan Molyneux. That's STEF as in Frank, AnMolyneux. UX, because nothing spells social media success like a silent X at the end of your name. And the youtube.com/freedomainradio. I guess those are the big ones.
Okay, great. Well, I enjoyed reading the book and I enjoyed this conversation. And I know you have enemies. I know I have enemies. Is it hard to believe that a genial guy like me could actually have an enemy? Like an
I'm a nice guy too. This is the surprising thing. But you know what Churchill said? He said to someone, "You have enemies. Good. That means you have stood up for something somewhere, sometime."
Yeah. Right. Right. I was at the 35th anniversary of the Mises Institute, and I stood up and I said, "You know, I know there are a lot of libertarians out there who, just because of their temperament, the cheekiest they can be is to tell people that price controls are bad and free trade is good. And if that's all you can contribute, that's fine. But I wonder, these people who tend to be the ones who are the quickest to attack me out of the blue, I mean, I don't bother with them unless they start it, but these people, I find in general, have never in their lives held a view that they thought they would be reviled for. Mm. They have no idea what that's like. I mean, there's no financial benefit I get from holding extremely unfashionable views that I will be reviled for. All I get in return is being reviled by fashionable people who want to build up their own name by trashing me. That's what I get in return. Now, I also get loyal listeners, I suppose. I don't want to discount that. But man, but just to put it that way, have you guys ever actually held an opinion that the New York Times wouldn't just be slightly annoyed by, but would really, really want to punish you for? And if not, then I don't think you really understand what the fight against the state is all about. It's about a lot more than being against price controls.
Well, you know, if you simply write abstract pieces saying that robbery is bad, then thieves don't really care. Why? Because you're not interfering with their immediate acquisition of property. But if you invent alarm systems, and if you buy people dogs, and if you get key codes and you build safes in people's houses, then you are immediately interfering with the unjust transfer of property sought by thieves. And so abstract principles, wonderful, fantastic. You know, we do need to guide ourselves by abstract principles. We need maps. We need compasses, we need GPSs, but we also need to get somewhere. And getting somewhere means, like, spreading virtue, spreading truth, spreading reasoning, means directly interfering with the material and political and personal profits of bad people. If bad people aren't annoyed by you, if bad people don't hate you, you're not doing any good. You're not actually achieving anything tangible. Because the spread of virtue harms the profits of vice. And if you are merely talking about virtue without harming the profits of vice, you're not doing anything fundamentally. And so when you harm the immediate profits of evil people, when you interfere with what they want, then they notice you. As the old saying goes, you only get flak when you're over the target and actually have bombs.
Yeah, there you go. And then it's at times like that that you say, well, it doesn't matter if I, you know, have to deal with some think tank president not liking me or some ridiculous thing like that, because I have an army of people who do like me. And in the age of the internet, that's all that counts.
Well, and it's funny to me as well, for Christians as well, Tom. I mean, how popular was Jesus in his day? And so the idea that we must seek popularity, or that the hatred of evil people is somehow a smear against our virtue, it's incomprehensible to me at a fundamental moral level, but particularly for Christians. The mark of dissatisfaction cast upon you by evildoers or those who have unjust power and authority, those who wield the coercive power of the state, those who are unjustly exploiting personal or professional or media relationships and so on, the idea that somehow people disliking you makes you a bad person, you are actually serving evildoers by holding that perspective, because you are empowering their desire to smear you. And this is something people really, there's not a neutral position. If you believe that people disliking someone makes that person bad, then you are the fuel that fires their attacks, because you're the reason they work.
Yeah, man, that's good stuff. Let's conclude on that note. And again, check out freedomainradio.com and Stefan's YouTube channel. Apparently the entire world subscribes to it. So, you know, that it must be good. Therefore, that's what I've concluded from reading your book on the argument. If a lot of people do something, it must be right. I think that's what you were trying to say. Anyway, thanks so much for your time, and best of luck with the book.
Thanks, Tom. A great pleasure.
All right, that's it for today. I release a new episode every weekday. Every weekday, you get your daily dose of Liberty education right here on The Tom Woods Show. So if you have not yet subscribed, please do so on iTunes or Stitcher. The links to do so you can find at tomwoods.com/episodes or /podcasts. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.